Okay. Hi, everybody. This is Elisa Pirmain from Boston, and I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Fred Luskin to join us. I found out about Fred quite a few years ago when I read his book, Forgive for Good, which is, I think, my favorite book on forgiveness because it's so story-oriented. It really talks about understanding how we get a grievance story and then how we change it to become a hero story. So Fred works out at Stanford University. He's done a lot of research on the benefits of forgiveness, both mentally, psychologically, and medically. And he's been involved in something I'd like to know more about, the Forgiveness Garden, the 9/11 Forgiveness Garden, and done some really interesting projects with people in Ireland. And so I don't exactly know, Fred, how you want to take this, but I'm very excited to hear what you have to share with us. And so if you would like to talk for about 30 minutes and then we'll open it up. Does that sound good?
And before you start, since we just had a bunch of people join us, let me repeat that we found it useful if you hit #6 to mute what's happening on your end while Fred talks. And then when we open up the discussion, you can hit #6 again to join us. So sorry for the interruption, Fred.
Well, that's okay. I will now mute myself as well. Ready, Fred?
Well, hi. I am out here at Stanford University, and I just finished teaching a positive psychology happiness class here. I'm sitting in the history department building, and it's very pleasant. There's nobody else in the room. It's beautiful out. I've been teaching and working with forgiveness for about the last 15, 16 years. It was not something that I expected to do, nor was it necessarily something that I wanted to do. It just kind of happened. And the reason that it happened is, is a story, but I was a postdoc at Stanford's medical school and was trying to get subjects for our project, which was a replication of my dissertation. My dissertation was a small randomized trial of a forgiveness intervention that I had created. And we got a grant to replicate it and make it bigger and, you know, to do it right. And I went to the Stanford Report, which is the in-house kind of Stanford paper, and asked them to do a recruitment for volunteers to, you know, show up and learn how to forgive and be part of our study and blah, blah, blah. So they agreed, and they wrote a nice article about, you know, forgiveness study looking for volunteers, and this was in 1997 or 8, and, you know, there was nobody doing this stuff. So Stanford was intrigued, and they put put resources behind it, and I'm out on Stanford's golf course playing golf one morning. I'm a postdoc at this time at the medical school. And I checked back in just to get my messages, of which there were never any, but just to make sure, I checked, and there were like 10 messages. And each of them was some variation of the question of, should Hillary forgive Bill? And I had no idea what they were talking. But there was all this, well, we're so interested in your work on forgiveness, and we just want to know if, you know, Hillary should forgive Bill Clinton. And I called one or two of these people back, and they explained to me that what had happened, that morning, the dress that Monica Lewinsky had kept with Bill Clinton's semen on it had been DNA identified as his, and the news desks got the faxes about both pieces of data, you know, that we have a forgiveness project and Bill Clinton was a cheat, and they called us up immediately to find out if Hillary should forgive Bill. And that's the flat truth as to why I'm sitting here talking to you, because I was a postdoc at Obscure with no sense of ever becoming well-known in any way, and then I got interviewed 1,000 times because of Hillary and Bill and Monica. And, you know, we were just starting this research project to show that forgiveness was healthy for mind and body, even though my dissertation study had hinted at it. My dissertation study was really small, and it wasn't great data. And then we ended up doing a 260-person study about the effect of a forgiveness intervention, which was and is the biggest intervention study by far in forgiveness literature. And that's how I became a forgiveness teacher, was Monica's help. So, you know, I'm well aware of what it means, and I'm not a storyteller per se, but I'm aware that people appear to be unforgiving and forgiving because of their stories. Like, it's the story that doesn't forgive, not the person. And you can make up any story you want about anything. And it's when I realized that my forgiveness intervention developed some power. That, you know, I got that you could tell any story you want. You could make up a story, you could lie, you could, you know, exaggerate one piece or another, you could focus on good, bad, or indifferent. You could do whatever you wanted. But the story determined the physical effect that the story had. It was like there was no physical effect without the story. And once I grasped that, the Forgiveness Project took off. And we were able to help tens of thousands of people because we understood that unforgiveness was a certain kind of story. And forgiveness was just a different story. And, you know, once it became that
it's
simple...
Can I just interrupt for 1 second? Some people who've just come on maybe haven't muted. Please, everybody, press #6. It's kind of a lot of background noise. Thanks. Sorry.
Hello?
Hi, Fred.
Yeah, and there's something very entertaining to me about that because, you know, I go all over and I have worked with people who have had almost every conceivable kind of horror happen to them, that they've been lied to and cheated and abused and abandoned and dismissed and everything. And I've dealt with family members who have had other people killed at 9/11, and we've done work with, you know, people murdered over political violence, and I'm going up not that long from now to do forgiveness work with Native people in absolute rural northern Canada and just everywhere in the world. And it all boils down to what kind of story do you want to tell about your own life? And the fact that I can present that, or we can present that so directly or simply, has allowed our work to be effective, that there's nothing abstract, there's nothing complicated, there's nothing deep. It's just that the story you tell determines its effect on your body. Then your body has a reciprocal relationship where the tension in your body then influences the kind of story you can tell. So if you're tense, you can't tell a loving, relaxed story. And if you want to change, you have to change the story. And we teach people how to tell kinder stories. I mean, that's essentially what we do. That there are all sorts of ways to tell benign, gentle, forgiving, compassionate, not harsh stories about life. And we try to educate people on that. And have been, you know, pretty successful. And the other piece that we add very strongly is a kind of stress management, self-regulation piece, because if you can't calm your nervous system down, then you know it's almost impossible to get a handle of anything else about anything. And so we teach, you know, a mind-body orientation with an overlay of basically narrative around it. And that has been the basis of our very successful forgiveness work for 15 or 16 years. And we've been able to show that, you know, forgiveness lowers blood pressure and, you know, reduces cortisol and allows you to become more hopeful and less depressed and less angry and blah, 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 blah. And as was said when this began, the basic change is the story changes from one of victimhood to some kind of coping, resilience, or heroism model. And that's a very effective and simple strategy and can be taught. It doesn't take that long to teach this to people. We do it mostly in an education model, but you can easily do it in a therapeutic model. It doesn't take like 6 months for somebody to learn how to talk differently about their life and to be encouraged to talk more gently or compassionately or kindly, either about themselves or somebody else. So, I mean, that's what I do. I don't know what else you'd like me to focus on. I could go through some of the steps we use. I don't care. I'm just here for you. But that's the very basics of how it is that we have conceptualized, developed a practice, written a couple of successful books, and you know, go literally into hell to teach people to do this. That I don't know that there's a harmful human situation that I haven't heard. And there is some helpfulness of forgiveness that cuts across all different harmful situations that befall human beings. So, do you have any other prompt for me, or do you want me to just go on? I mean, what would be helpful?
Can you hear me, Fred?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good. Well, there are, I think perhaps maybe if you did talk a little bit just about how you teach people about how they form a grievance story, that would be great. And then I love what you do about positive intention stories. So maybe if you could sort of that sequence a little bit.
Yeah, so a little more specific about this.
And then maybe some examples of places like your Northern Ireland work or something that strikes you as a good example of uses of this.
Okay. Well, the best example is the most common. The most common thing that we get into forgiveness classes and things are women with ex-husbands from hell. That is by far and away the biggest catchment. Women in their late 40s, early 50s, whose husbands have found somebody else, who were not good as partners, who were not good parents, that's by far and away the largest number of people that we see, and it has been so for 15 years. The best story that comes from that is, you know, I hated him, and now I don't need that anymore. That I can see him as a human being. I can see us as a failed experiment. And I need to let go of my clinging to this experience. That's the best that we get, because it's so common and needed all over the place. I remember one experience with a woman. I was teaching a continuing education class out of whatever Stanford's Department of Continuing Studies was, and I'm talking about forgiveness, and she literally jumps up out of her seat and says, you know, this forgiveness stuff is great, but you never met my ex-husband, basically. You know, if you had met my ex-husband, you would have given up on the idea of forgiveness. And, you know, I remember looking at her and me being a somewhat sarcastic New Yorker, like I'm thinking, God, the ex-husband got out just in the nick of time. You know, like this is somebody who jumps up in the middle of a class to tell that. So you're thinking she probably wasn't the easiest person to live with. That being said, I remember asking her, like, what is so shocking about a husband leaving you? Like, what's shocking about that? And she said, well, you know, we were married. And I said, yeah, but, you know, we live in a country with a 50%+ divorce rate. So, like, what's shocking about it? And she said, well, it was terrible. And I said, yeah, but what was shocking about it? And she, you know, she didn't get that it was her lack of anticipation or understanding of the way life is that made it shocking, not the event. So then she had created an entire victim story around an experience that is very, very common, albeit very painful. There's no minimizing that. But the shock that she had was from her lack of awareness of relationship, and from my experience now, her lack of empathy and compassion for the amount of suffering that exists on this planet. So that's the most common by far experience of a story, a contorted, harsh, hostile story of aggrievement over a partner who did something wrong and is no longer with them. So the grievance story is what we create to lock a problem in place so it's not easily challenged. That there's a very, I mean, I just called it a grievance story. That's just my name for it. It doesn't mean that that's actually what it is. But that's my name for the creation of a way of looking at our own life that limits us and freezes something into a negative place and time. That a specific way of looking at things, and from my surmise, comes from three separate things. One is we took something too personally. Like we took a life event that happens all over the place, and we took it way too personally. Like we had no connection to the bigger picture in any way. So we had no connection to how common it is. We had no connection to our psychophysiologic responsiveness that causes some of these reactions. We had no connection to, a certain willingness to suffer, and we had no connection for how other people might have felt about us. So we were like disconnected from a lot of truth around an experience, and then a very painful experience happened. So instead of having some dispassion or some awareness that these things are part of being human and suffering is inherent in being a human being, as, you know, the Buddha's first noble truth, we react very strongly to the offense itself and take it very personally because it happened to us. Then that personal reactivity causes all sorts of biochemical changes, which are very uncomfortable and very destabilizing. You know, it's like our whole stressful system goes on alert, and we're dealing with cortisol and adrenaline and, you know, norepinephrine and all sorts of hormonal changes and blah, 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 blah. And they're all designed to make us very uncomfortable and very destabilized. And what we do is we take that discomfort and sense of being destabilized and we blame it on something outside of ourselves rather than our own innate reactivity to experience. So we find an enemy and then we become a victim of that enemy. And that process is rehashed over and over and over again in our minds. It shouldn't have happened because it happened to me. It's terrible because it happened to me. What an awful thing because it happened to me. They meant to harm me. They're terrible people because they harmed me. All those are narratives of our way of taking it too personally, which floods our nervous system with stress every single time that happens. then we take that stress and that discomfort and blame it on somebody else rather than evaluating the effectiveness of our stress response, or our own nervous system, or our own capacity for growth and healing. We make it somebody else's issue, and then we blame them for how we react. And the blame solidifies this reactivity as caused by somebody else and then needing to be changed by somebody else. And therefore, we're helpless and victimized by somebody else's cruelty on a regular basis. Not just that they did this cruelty once, but continue to harm us. So we have this personalization and blame occurring regularly and even relentlessly. And that causes a cycle of dependence, or a cycle of reactivity on the victim, you know, to the victimizer. That, you know, my nervous system is triggered. I can't stop it. You have to do something for me to stop it. You're not doing something. Therefore, I'm helpless and can't be in control of myself. And that's a very low efficacy way to create a narrative about one's life. And then that narrative or story locks into place the personal, terrible nature of what happened and our own helplessness to control our own reactivity. And then when one has told that story like 7 or 8 or 10 times, that story becomes hardwired as our memory of what happened. And there's very little room to change that memory, because it's connected by the nervous system. You know, it's like this is how it is, and that becomes very, very, very resistant to change. Very resistant. And so, what we have to do is accept that at least during the period of grief, some of those stories are necessary. When grief has started to ebb, the story itself has to change markedly. And most people struggle to change that story because they've been so used to having adrenaline in their system when they think about what happened that they feel vulnerable and naked without it. And that's what locks into place the victim status or the victim mentality. The positive intention story is one of the simple ways that we have figured out to get people to tell a different story. And it's not that big a deal. It's just relating to two possible good outcomes of being hurt. One, what did you learn about yourself? Or two, what did you want from the experience that hurt you that you didn't get, that you try to get met in another way? Like, what did you want? And, you know, that's a very, very, very simple way of changing a story. And so we ask people to tell a positive intention story, which is, I either grew in this way from this experience, which is I saw a flaw, or I have seen that what I really wanted was love. I may not get love from Charlie or Jose, but I may get love from somebody else, and I can learn to be okay with that. But I can learn to be okay with like not getting it exactly the way I wanted it, but getting it close. And that positive intention story is really helpful, and that has just helped so many people do better. So that's what I was asked to do. Anything else I can offer, or I'm here for questions or comments?
Great. Thank you. Can you hear me, Fred?
Of course.
I never know if I do it right. Thank you so much for outlining that That is so clear and lovely, and I have tried that positive intention story with clients and definitely had agree that it's something lights up in their face when they think about, well, what do I want and what do I need, really. The bigger story, as you call it, is a lovely shift. I think I know other people will probably have questions. I know your work with people from Northern Ireland, that was quite a long time ago, wasn't it?
That was about 10 years ago.
10 years ago. But what was so amazing to me was that you had people from both sides, and I think the second time you had women come over to California, you paid to have them come over. And
we did that a few times,
and they had all lost children or husbands or significant people in their lives. And I'm just interested in how that process, you know, how, if there was anger initially between the two groups, and how that got resolved. I guess that's my question.
Like, how did I get involved with that?
Well, how did you, I mean, when these women came over and they've been holding this, you know, terrible grief from these losses, and there's so much anger between the two sides, the Catholic and the Protestants, was that an issue in the forgiveness groups themselves?
No, not at all.
But we
were very careful. The reason that the forgiveness groups came about was my partner in this was kind of a back-channel diplomat in the Northern Ireland peace process. And he was setting up dialogue groups or to attempt to create communication between the two sides. And what would happen is the dialogue groups would run aground because there was so much bitterness from some of the murders that had gone on that people became unable to talk beyond the grievances. Well, you killed this person, and no, you killed that person, or you harmed this. And so the dialogue ground to a halt because there was such a need for forgiveness. So his first idea was, well, let's take some of these people who have had the worst of the wounds and see if we can help them forgive and use this as a demonstration project to show that forgiveness could be of help in Northern Ireland. So the first group was chosen to be women who had had their sons murdered from both sides, but we chose people who at least agreed to come and try to work on their own healing, not just, you know, keep the war going. The second group we brought was three times the size, but it was anybody who had had an immediate family member murdered. And it was that they could have had a brother, sister, son, you know, father, anything murdered from both sides. And again, this time there were like, you know, 20 people or 18 people. And again, it was the same thing. The third time we actually had happen what you're talking about, where we brought some community members who were involved in the healing, but they were from both sides. Not all of them themselves had been grievously wounded. So they had their own issues, and those issues emerged and made the dialogue much more difficult than it was with people who were there because they really only had their own issues. Like, that turned out to be an easier way of doing it than people who had, you know, they were there more like with an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And that third one was very problematic because a lot of people had stuff. And I saw the potential, which I hadn't seen in the other groups, for the unprocessed stuff to stop all dialogue of healing and goodness.
Wow. Well, I think maybe at this point we would ask everyone to unmute if you would like to the conversation and ask Fred a question. I know I've been hogging the microphone here. So is there anybody else?
Hi. Yeah, this is Noah. Hello.
Hi, Noah. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm very curious. This situation that you just described, where people came with so much agenda. So what did you do? Could you describe what was the process through your forgiveness methodology that you actually used in that situation? I'm very curious to hear that.
Well, I use the exact same one in all situations. There was nothing different because these people had family members murdered or anything than because they didn't like their neighbor's haircut. Forgiveness is forgiveness. And we do our best not to be distracted by people's stories. That we have a desire to go in there and help them change their story, not get lost in their story with them. And one of the tenets of the work we do is that people are absolutely lost in this story. They're just swimming, terribly lost in it, in particular if it's a hostile story. And so in order to be of help to them, we have to stop them from telling that story that's so crippling to them. So the process wasn't any different than we would use with anybody else. And if you want to find out more about that process, I have the 9 Steps to Forgiveness on my website, and the book Forgive for Good details the whole process, and you can use that book as a teaching tool. I mean, it's the best-selling forgiveness book out there.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Hi, Fred. This is Elizabeth in Boston. When you were describing the process, you said that the challenge of changing the grievance story is threefold. It comes from 3 different things. And you, to my knowledge, only spoke about personalization and blame. What were the other 2?
Fred, are you there?
I'm right here.
Okay. Did you hear that question?
I must not have.
Can you hear me now?
I can. I've always heard you. I just didn't get the question.
Okay. The question is, you had spoken about 3 different things that causes discord and a blockage from forgiveness. And the first one you explained was personalization and blame. What were the
other
2?
Well, that's 2. Personalization is 1. Blame is 2.
Okay. And what is 3?
Creating a story out of that, which cements in the personalization and the blame.
I see. Thank you.
You're welcome.
One thing that you said, Fred, that I thought was so interesting was about how adrenaline is addictive and how once we get used to having that feeling, it's almost like a, would you call it maybe protective device? As part of holding our story in place, we feel, when we have adrenaline coursing, do we feel more powerful in a way?
You know, I've been contemplating that question for many, many, many years. And I don't totally know the answer to that question. I have a couple of surmises, but I haven't nailed this. One is, I think that people are so afraid of their vulnerability that they will do almost anything not to experience that.
Right.
And so adrenaline serves as a false sense of energy and achievement about something. So if you feel adrenaline, then you can avoid that unbelievably painful feeling of being helpless and vulnerable, which I believe people need to experience as part of grief to move on. But that is a very challenging thing to feel, how helpless you can be in the world. and that painful, unpleasant, harsh things can happen whether you want it to or not. It's like, what is that description, which is, you know, like a piranha doesn't care if you're a vegetarian. You know what I mean? It's like you can be a really nice person who doesn't eat anything. They'll still rip you apart. That is really, really challenging for people to hold, that by just being nice or gentle or generous or sweet often has no influence on events at all. And so what they do is they create a drama line where adrenaline comes and they can feel energized and somewhat more protective, so they don't have to feel that vulnerability and helpless, which is unfortunately part of the way that one heals, is by owning the vulnerability and helplessness and then trying to figure out what to do with it rather than masking it. So I think that's part of it. And the other thing is, it's probably just a lack of skill development, that most of us have no idea how to regulate our emotions. So we're just left willy-nilly bouncing around from one emotional experience to another. And it's not just the secondary gain, but it's the lack of skill. And, you know, we're not well-trained about emotional regulation, or we're not well-trained about any of these things. So it's very challenging to handle these kind of experiences.
Right. Right. So I noticed a lot of what you do is helping people to just learn how to breathe and let feelings be in a compassionate way, to move through that.
Well, an adrenaline-backed story is generally like just a fancy term for the limitations of fight-or-flight thinking. So almost the only thing we get out of our adrenaline-backed story is some manifestation, some representation of thinking that is fight or flight. And so what people take to have these stories and think they're so brilliant, when they're just the most primitive parts of our body screaming at us. So we might think, I hate them and I don't like them, or stay away from me, but that's just adrenaline, fight or flight. Or we may think that, you know, I need to punish them and I can plan revenge. And again, those are just adrenaline-backed statements that, you know, that chipmunks have, except, you know, not as sophisticated, but they have the same kind of simplistic thinking that we do. You know, once you've activated that, you know, hypothalamic pituitary axis. And so one of the things that we try to explain to people is that you can do better than that, like you actually have much more intelligence than you're using to bring to this situation. And the constant use of adrenaline is limiting your brain and limiting your smarts and actually stopping you from solving the problem, that you have a problem to solve and you're not doing so. And so, you know, that's a significant part of what it is that we're trying to educate people to, that, you know, there's a problem in your life. Someone has harmed you, and you have to figure out the best way to handle it. And if the story you're telling is so stereotypical and so simplistic, you don't have a chance of solving it. You just will be in that same repetitive groove of the same old, same old. And so that forms the basis of a lot of the work, that, you know, there's untapped potential in your brain that adrenaline and a one-trick pony story make impossible to find.
Wow. So anybody else have a question out there? A lot of of walking around.
Well, this is
What's
Elizabeth
that?
Again. I do have another question. I'd like you, Fred, if you could explain how you use empathy and compassion to bring out the story and change it. I know that nonviolent communication is one way that I have found to deal with that, and I also work with something called heart-mind integration, which goes and finds the wounded parts, hears their story, heals them, and then brings them back to make us whole again, which is very powerful work. So can you tell us what you use to change the story?
Well, one of the things that we do is we don't try to have people be empathic or compassionate for the people that hurt them. That's a big reach, and we're mostly doing education, and that actually can interfere with the speed of their progress, because that's a huge gulf. What we try to do is give them some capacity to have empathy and compassion for their own suffering and their predicament.
Yes, that's
and
what I meant, actually, for them.
Yeah,
for the victim,
that to just turn a non-adversarial lens to their own life, which is, you know, you're hurt, and it's very challenging, and there's no enemy, you're just hurt. And it's difficult to be hurt, but that's part of the dance here as a person. And we provide them, like, opportunity for guided practice in calming down and relaxing their bodies and maybe thinking of loving images or positive images, just something to get their focus off the pain. And then telling an entirely different story based on, like, their own woundedness and how, you know, it's sad, but it's not catastrophic, or it's common, or, you know, this was a really difficult thing to deal with, and it may carry cost for a while. But the whole point is to remove nervous system reactivity. And once nervous system reactivity has been removed, then people are free to tell all sorts of different stories. Like, they don't need coaching in the same way. So what I have found is it doesn't really matter what the portal of entry is. It's just something comes in there and reminds them that they're not at a war, and they can take a deep breath, and they can, you know, soften their belly and their heart. And then, oh, okay. And then the story that naturally comes out of them is different. And, you know, I will cut people off. But I've had people tell me that they think they're compassionate when they say, you know, the reason my father was an asshole was because he wasn't loved as a child. So that's a very common attempt at compassion that I hear. And you know, that I will suggest that calling somebody an asshole suggest some limitations in one's compassion, but it's a very simple process of just refinement of, you know, that again, inside of each of us is like a whole nervous system just waiting to be uncovered and used that can speak without an enemy needed. And a lot of what we do is try to orient people to that nervous system. So I would say, more than nonviolent communication or anything like that, I would say gratitude practice or appreciation practice has a lot to do with how we reorient people.
So this is Gert Johnson from Schenectady. I had a question for you. I'm wondering how often, or if you do run into people who are terribly angry with God.
I say that once more.
Pardon? Who are terribly angry with God or feeling helpless because they feel that God has visited things upon them.
Well, I mean, my own personal experience is the object of who we're angry with doesn't matter as much as we think it does. that it's the process of being angry that's the problem. That said, many, many people are angry at themselves or other people or the universe or God or whatever explanatory mechanism they come up with. But I'm more interested in why it is they come up with an explanatory mechanism that's us.
Right.
Like, why would they need, what is it about them that needs hostility as opposed to acceptance, respect, compassion? Like, what is it that needs to have an enemy in there? It doesn't matter who the enemy is, at least from the way I see it. I mean, I may be wrong about that, but we do create a lot of enemies when we don't like the result. I mean, that's really what it is. And so I might describe it as, okay, you didn't like the result. You didn't like what happened. Now, how can you create a more adaptive way of dealing with that which you don't like?
Right.
So I don't, you know, it's the content is not as important to me.
Okay.
You know, it's just fascinating to me that I'm sitting here now outside of Stanford University in California, that I'm on the phone with people all over the United States. Very cool. It really is. It's just amazing. You know, I'm just sitting here in a car with a little cell phone, and, you know, there's people from all over the United States.
Right. Yeah. Sort of speaking of that, it sounds like you grew up in New York. Is that right?
I did.
And some people probably know better than I, but it sounds like there's been an attempt to start a forgiveness, a 9/11 forgiveness garden, and it's been stalled, and you've been involved with that, is that right?
I was involved in it a while ago, and it met with so much resistance, but in large part that was because every single thing about the 9/11 site met with resistance. So it wasn't just the forgiveness garden. It's that it was impossible to get anything done. There was just so much bickering and confusion and everything. It was just awful. I mean, there was so much pain there. And different groups had different ownership and different needs and different everything. So I was working with somebody who had a real beautiful image of planting a garden of forgiveness right there at the redevelopment site as a reminder that human beings should never again do this. And we had a little bit of support, and there was interest for a while, and it just became too difficult to get anybody to agree about anything. I mean, not just the garden of forgiveness. It was, you know, every single thing that occurred on that site was contentious and painful.
Oh, boy.
This is Penny from Boston. I'm curious about your success with the Northern Irish groups compared, and how that compares to the lack of success with the work with Ground Zero.
The Irish people had a peace process. The government was involved in negotiating and planning and thinking. And so there was something coming from the top which allowed some of the stuff emerging from the bottom to have resonance.
Okay.
It's one of the reasons why very little has been done positive in Israel and Palestine, that there's really no successful or positive top-down anything. And so it's very hard for local initiatives to get much traction. We benefited from the fact that community was sick enough of what it was doing to each other, that they were actively involved at higher level negotiations, and, you know, George Mitchell was sent there as a peace emissary, and so it wasn't in isolation. It wasn't like just pushing rocks uphill. There was already some modest political structure in place. And I think that made all the difference.
That's very interesting.
I have a logistical question, I guess. How can we get a copy of this evening's conference call?
Well,
Allison, are you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think it's going to be up on the website very shortly.
Can you hear me?
Allison?
This is Allison. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, good. It is on. It should be posted on the website within, I would say, within the week. The person who is our webmaster is on vacation, so I hate to give you the wrong date, but soon. And I will post on the Healing Story listserv when it is up there. That will be helpful. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and do you have to be a current member of the Healing SIG?
Nope. We're pretty much take the tact of public television. We appreciate the support of all of our members, and we put the information out there for everyone.
Great. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Oh, are we? Does anyone else have a question? Shall we? Maybe it's time to wind it up and say thank you so much, Fred, for
you're welcome.
Sharing this time and sharing your wonderful book and all the work that you do around the world. I hope we will continue to hear more about what you do.
Thank you very much, and good luck with all your stories. This has been a fun world to bump into, so I appreciate it. Thank you, everybody.
And good
thank
luck
you.
To the storytelling class.